My wife had the so-called Today Show on the TV, and they said, "We are welcoming now Bishop Pike, who, he's been on their program many, many times." But they said, "Bishop Pike has just announced that he's left the church." And they said he has an article in Look magazine explaining the reason. And we want him to tell a little bit about the reason to our people. And so Bishop Pike was there, and he looked very unusual without his clerical garment and without a big cigarette in his hand. He looked very strange. And he talked in a mumbling way. It was hard to understand him. When the last time I saw him, he talked very directly and was easy to understand. When he was defending his right to be a bishop of the Episcopal Church and telling how they should give up all the old-fashioned supernatural foolish ideas. But now he said, the church is in a decline, he said. The church is going to completely disappear soon. The church as an organization, people are going to leave us because the conservative laymen won't give enough money to support the intelligent leadership we have now, and the church is declining, and he told how money was falling off, and membership was falling off, and he has left it, and he's going to continue his work outside the church. And it was very interesting, the attitude that he took and the views that he expressed. We want to be familiar with these developments in our own day, with tremendous things happening. And whether the Lord certainly will keep his word alive, there's no doubt of that. But I feel sorry for the great multitude of people in the Episcopal Church and in all the other denominations, many of whom as children heard the true word of God, many of whom heard a great deal of gospel truth and Christian truth as young people, and now for years they've been hearing the arid teachings of liberalism and destructive criticism, and they don't understand what's wrong, they're confused, and many of them will lose all interest, some of them will drift out, and if only we could get to these people and bring them an understanding of the true gospel. It is a very serious situation, and one in which every Christian should be trying to make his life count to win souls to Christ and to push back the apostasy. Well, we're looking now at a very interesting period in church history, the 13th century, a period which the Roman Catholic Church and its leaders at least 30 years ago almost unanimously believed was the greatest period in the history of the church. We have looked at some of the great scholars in our last heading, and then we're going to make number F, conclusion regarding the 13th century. It is such an important century in church history that we want to glance again at some of its main things before moving on to the very different 14th century. In this case, the century division makes a rather definite point of change in history. Of course, changes don't occur suddenly. You find their results suddenly sometimes, but they proceed gradually, and yet the century is very different from the one that follows. Under this conclusion regarding the 13th century, I want to make number one the papacy. McSorley in his church history, this Roman Catholic history, it's gone through many edits by the Roman Catholic Church, says in his, he arranges by centuries, and he calls the 13th century, the 1200s, the papacy dominant, while the 1300s he calls the decline. And I have seen books written by Neil Thomas, who has spoken of the 13th century as the great time of intellectual light and understanding, at the high point in Christian thought, in their opinion. Well, certainly some of the writers of that day have a great influence to the present day. In the history of scholasticism, it was indeed the great century. The papacy, I make number one under this, because the papacy was indeed more dominant in that century than it had ever been before or has ever been since. It was a time when the papacy was able to carry out its claims of supremacy more effectively than ever before or since. and the times when those claims were voiced most positively and strongly. We begin with Innocent III, near the beginning of the century, who was the very strongest of all the popes. He interfered in the affairs of just about every country of Europe, and often on good moral grounds. And he declared that the rulers should be subject to the Pope, and often succeeded in carrying out his desire, but also he failed on a number of occasions. And the succeeding Pope, they all tried to be as powerful as Innocent III, but none of them quite came up to that point. And as the century went on, it became harder and harder to get a new Pope elected. When a man has that much power, it becomes tremendously important to every country who is going to occupy the position. And toward the end of the century, you remember the story of the poor old man, Peter Moroni, who became Pope Celestine VI. And he, you'll remember, was taken simply as an old man because they couldn't agree. For some years they hadn't been able to agree on a pope, so they got this old hermit out of the mountain and brought him in and made him pope, thinking that that would postpone the decision for a short time. But thousands of people of high standards felt that indeed now the monument was going to come, because you were going to have a really spiritual man as pope. And the poor old hermit did his best to live up to it, but made an awful failure of it. And in the end, you remember, he gave it up in disgust, partly helped, perhaps, by Cardinal Gaetano's stratagem. And after he abdicated, the new pope arrested him and put him in a cell where he died from the treatment he received. But the new pope then was Boniface VIII at the end of the century. And to trace the century from Innocent III to Boniface VIII is very interesting, because what Innocent III was able to do, Boniface VIII tried to do. And what Innocent III claimed, Boniface VIII claimed in stronger and more explicit language. He declared that for salvation it is necessary to be subject to the Pope at Rome, that his authority was over all rulers, all governments, that all must be subject to him if they are to be saved. He expressed in his declaration some of these claims in the very strongest imaginable language. But in the end, he came into conflict with the King of France and with certain of the Italian nobles and lost out shortly after the beginning of the next century. We speak more about that as we enter the next century, but here we note further in relation to the papacy, we notice that though the papacy made these great claims through this century, they were never able to enforce them without considerable difficulty. Here is McSorley in his summary of the 1200, and he mentions some of the relations between the kings and the popes during this century. He says, all in all, excommunications were launched against emperors and kings on more than 10 occasions in this century. Emperors or kings excommunicated on more than 10 occasions in the century. And at least 6 kings were deposed or threatened. And the popes, in order to maintain themselves, had to resist forces that were rising. And the first of those forces, of course, was the Albigenses. And the Albigenses, as we know it, were not a Christian group. So they paid great respect to the Bible and great respect to certain Christian teachings, yet they did not follow the principal teachings of Christianity. They had an entirely different idea of God. They had a dualism rather than belief in a sovereign God. So they did maintain high moral standards. They claimed them, and many of them certainly maintained them. But faced with them, Innocent III proclaimed a crusade against them, and the result of it was that tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people were killed in this so-called crusade. And southern France was reduced almost to a desert, which had been the finest part of France. And then, in order to maintain their position, they continued with the Inquisition. And the Inquisition succeeded in rooting out the Albigenses. People sometimes say that persecution only makes a thing stronger, which of course is not true at all. Persecution may make a thing stronger, but it depends how strong the persecution is. In the providence of God, the great persecutions under the Roman Empire gave strength to the church, but one reason is that none of them were continued for many years in a row until you got to the last. Diocletian's persecution was quite long, continued for nearly 10 years in various parts of the empire. But before that, practically every persecution that was at all feared was of short duration. And people were able to see for a short period of time to see the constancy and the courage of those who suffered under persecution. And then the persecution was lifted, and people were able to flock into the church, admiring those who had suffered and died and whose constancy they had seen, but not themselves having to fear danger in entering the church. And when a new persecution would start, there would always be a great many who would drop out, who did not have the courage to face it. But in the providence of God, it was persecution followed by relief from persecution, which was so helpful to the church in those days. That's what we have in England, as we look at next year. Mary Tudor, who was Queen of England for 5 years, during those 5 years, burned 300 Protestants, most of the ministers or bishops at the stake. And it was a very fiery persecution in England. But it only lasted, it was the last three of the 5 years. And then she died, and the persecution completely stopped. And the impression made by the bravery and constancy and loyalty to the convictions of these men had a great deal to do with making England into a Protestant nation, when before that time, while there were many very, very intelligent and very, very devoted Protestants in the country, probably three-fourths of the people had been more or less indifferent. But the persecution for a limited time and then coming to a stop was greatly used to advance the gospel in England. In Poland, we have a different situation where the Jesuits took control when a third of the people, including the greater part of the nobility, were Protestant. The Jesuits took control and introduced the persecution and the Inquisition, not on a basis like in England with a few great scenes where people were publicly killed, but with a steady, constant persecution and Inquisition and clearing out of Protestant leadership, with the result that Protestantism practically died in Poland. And although that country, at the time of Mary Tudor, had far more Protestants in it than England had, it is hard even to find a good book on Protestantism in Poland, because it was so completely wiped out as a result of persecution continuing over a long time. Well, one thing that the Pope carried through consistently was their persecution against the Albigenses. First, so-called crusade, and then the Inquisition, which rooted them out one by one. And it was probably 50 or 60 years after the crusade before they had disappeared. But I doubt if 100 years, I doubt if by the beginning of the next century, by 1300, I doubt if you could find anybody in Europe who you would really class as an Albigenser. It was very effective in putting an end to this. But this movement, which had become so great, would have become a very considerable force in Europe if it had not been wiped out by the crusade, followed by the Inquisition. And then, during this century, one of the great things, perhaps we should make that number two here, the rise of the friars. Number two, the rise of the friars. We've spoken at some length about them. They were a new development in monasticism, and they are a tremendously important development in monasticism, and they are tremendously important to this very day. And the Franciscans and the Dominicans are so active in the field of religious activity to this day that anyone in religious things should know something about when they started, how they differed from previous movements, how they interacted upon each other, what high ideals characterized many of them at the start, and to how great and how these ideals were twisted and changed. The Dominicans, the order devoted to preaching and to argument, being changed to some extent into being the leaders of the Inquisition. So that is largely a matter of the past now. Today, the Dominicans are very active in scholarship and in writing. But, and they always were, to some extent. But the order was greatly injured by the Pope ordering them to take over the Inquisition and the Communist part. They played it to the centuries. The Franciscans, on the other hand, with Francis' ideal of absolute poverty and getting away from the things of this world and putting your thoughts on heavenly things and away from earthly things entirely, going through their great struggle in subsequent years as the Pope turned them into an order that would be his soldier for carrying out of his purposes, but that and that would become, as far as this was concerned, it would be largely a symbol. And yet there always were men entering the Franciscans who had been tremendously affected by the story of St. Francis and who wanted the order to really carry on his ideas. Yes? It refers to the Franciscans and Dominicans and to the other similar orders, which are also called mendicants. These are orders which did not simply build a monastery and separate from the world with the idea they were just off there to take care of their own spiritual life, but men who were thought of as separate from the world in order to go out into the world and to be active in it. Francis' idea that they should go about as poor people helping others in every possible way. Dominic's idea they should go about preaching and presenting their ideas and trying to influence the thinking of others. But it is very different from the previous monastic idea. The monasteries previously, many of them had done much to help people and done much to advance scholarship, but been incidental and on the side, and not a purpose of it. This was their purpose now. And they called, I suppose the term brothers would have been just equally properly, logically applied to the monks before. But now these monks were going out into the towns and around more, and they referred to them as the brothers, and the term friars came to mean simply the mendicant order. Dominicans, Franciscans, and the Augustinians, there's one branch of the Augustinians was this way, another branch of them was conventual, so called, and there were one or two others left. Yes? Yes, there are several such designations for particular orders which had a particular type of robe. And two or three times I've memorized which were the black stripes, which were the gray, and the green and the red, or whatever they are. I don't think it's particularly important to keep them in mind, unless you're having a lot to do with them, then it might be difficult to do. But of course, now they don't usually wear the robes in Protestant countries. And so you'll run on to a Dominican or a Franciscan on the train here and never suspect such a thing. But in Romanist countries, very largely, they do wear the robes, so I suppose they would recognize that or not. Yes? The word mendicant literally means begging. Yes. And previously, the monks, while they might sometimes beg, it was not considered as in any way a typical thing. They got off into the desert, off by themselves. People might give them gifts. But now the Francis idea was they should go about and work just for their livelihood, but not to save anything. But pretty soon people seeing these men working this way and having nothing of their own began giving them things, and pretty soon they were begging. And so it came within a few decades to where every fire was thought of as constantly begging, and they called them the mendicant. And we would use the term mendicant today for a beggar, so, sort of a form of reproach, but it seemed to be sort of a badge. Yes. Well, the friars then are a very, the rise of the friars is a very distinctive thing about this particular period, and something which continued, with changes, of course, but continued to be a very vital factor up to the present day. And then, of course, we referred to the Albert Jensen Crusade and the Inquisition. Perhaps we should make number three the Inquisition, because it is not merely of interest as something that wiped out the Albigenses, because that is a historical thing that is past, but it is something that affected other phases of life very much as well. We notice that the nature, the way the Inquisition was conducted, there was no check on it. There was no chance for any appeal from it. There was no opportunity for a real examination of the fact. And so it was easy for a man who was jealous of someone else and heard him make an idle remark to report him to the Inquisition authority. And I'm sure there were many cases where people were reported where the inquisitors decided this is just somebody's jealousy and paid no attention. But if the inquisitors were so mind-deaf, they might go ahead and a man might lose all his property, might very well lose his life, might suffer torture, simply on the word of somebody who was jealous of him. And the Inquisition continued to be a very disagreeable feature in European life up till within a century or two of the present time. And of course, this laid a established a situation in which one would never believe that anything like the Reformation could have occurred. And it shows, it makes it easy to understand how Luther felt after the Inquisition began. He never felt at all sure he'd have more than another year or two at most before he would be seized and his life would be put to an end. And it was in the providence of God that Luther was enabled to live out his years and to have a tremendous influence through his speaking and his writing, which continues to this day, although unfortunately not nearly as much in the Lutheran Church, I fear, as in other groups, as the Lutheran Church having been so infiltrated with modernism in the last century. So the Missouri Lutherans were very conservative 15 years ago. And during these last 5 years particularly, modernism has been coming in with tremendous force into the so-called Missouri Lutherans, which are maybe a fourth of the total body of Lutherans in America. And of course, among the other Lutheran groups, too, 50 years ago, there would have been many centers where there was a real emphasis on Luther's teaching of salvation by faith. But the seminaries have been more and more pushing in the liberal direction and more trying to get control of the churches. If you would take this area here, the Lutheran churches in this part of Pennsylvania, 50 years ago, each one was independent. Each one had absolute control over its ministry and its life 50 years ago. Today, they have a central organization which has such a power over them that it is almost impossible for any one of them to resist control in anything in which the central organization desires to exert its will. And when it comes to getting a new minister, the man who was the head of it explained to me 10 years ago, he said, I recommend three men. And he said, if they don't take one of them, I recommend three others. But he said, in most cases, they take one of the three I recommend. And there was nothing like that among the 50s. But there's a control has been established, as in most present-day denominations. You had a question, please?
Yes, sir. Let's talk to say that close to 400,000 members, you are only
Wisconsin Synod is like the Missouri Synod in many ways, but I am not personally professor. This Magazine Christian News, which is edited by a Lutheran minister, keeps a pretty good tab on all the different Lutheran branches. It is my impression that I have met one or two professors from the Wisconsin Synod who impressed me as moving pretty strongly in the liberal direction. But how much influence they have in the church, I'm not sure. I haven't really studied this particular aspect of the church yet. So much then for number three, the Inquisition. But then number four, scholarship. Scholarship. The scholarship of the 13th century was far in advance of anything that had been since the fall of the Roman Empire. There had been nothing like it. The Roman Empire, of course, was a time of widespread thinking and writing and time of high civilization. But with the coming of the barbarians, civilization largely disappeared from Europe. Literacy largely disappeared from Europe. And if it were not for the monasteries in which they had to give the monks something to do to make it easier for them to stay out of mischief, and they had them copying manuscripts and that sort of thing, why, we might not even know there's been a Roman civilization. But gradually, the level of civilization lifted during the century. And the 12th century, we noticed, had a few really outstanding thoughts. Now the 13th went way beyond the 12th. I don't know if any of its men were greater scholars than one or two of the best in the 12th, but they had a far greater number of scholars. And of course, most of them come toward the end of the century. The Franciscan and Dominican orders contributed greatly to scholarship because they provided a group, a large group of men, among whom there was a zeal to defeat the other order in getting more of their men into high positions in the universities. And there was a competition between the two orders and within the orders. And there was also a livelihood for men interested in scholarship in these orders. And the result is there's a much larger number of scholars. And some of them have come over into the beginning of the next century we'll look at under the next head. But of all I mentioned to you, the one whose influence remains to this day most strongly is Thomas Aquinas. And he is one who has such a tremendous influence in the world today, or at least did have 20 years ago. And I imagine still has very considerable. And his books are studied in all Roman schools, and he has an influence in many ways. And we should then remember Thomas Aquinas, for sure. And in connection with Thomas Aquinas, we should be aware of the great influence of Aristotle on him. This is one thing that Luther reacted against. Luther felt that paganism had entered Aquinas' teaching through Aristotle. He felt that Aristotle had had a very bad influence on the church of his day. Now, to how great an extent, how much of this Luther was justified in blaming on Aristotle, one would have to be a much greater student of Aristotle than I've ever been to make a fair judgment. But it is a fact of history that is of which we should be aware. The tremendous influence of Aristotle. Undoubtedly, Aristotle was one of the greatest minds in the history of the world. And of Aristotle's works were to a very slight extent known in the 12th century. But in the 13th century, as we noticed, Aristotle's works, which had been translated from Greek into Syriac, and then from Syriac into Arabic, were then translated from Arabic into Latin in Spain. And this these very poor translations, because they'd gone through all these different stages, still were sufficiently stimulating that many people in the 13th century thought anything that Aristotle said was certainly true. And Aristotle was considered to be just about an infallible authority. And the Aquinas was tremendously influenced by his reading of Aristotle. Well, there's one scholar who we might have looked at under this century, because his life straddles the century, 13th into the 14th century. Last year I looked at him under the 13th century. I'm going to this year under the 14th century. And it's good to put him under a different head because he's so different from these other men, even though influenced by him. So we look at him a little later. Yes? Well, of course, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle were the succession of the three great Greek philosophers. All we know about Socrates, mostly know about him, is what Plato wrote about him. But I'm sure that everyone that had any connection with Plato has been influenced by him. But it is my impression that the influence of Aristotle on Aquinas was many times as great as that of Plato. And there are many who have reacted against Aristotle in favor of Plato, more particularly in later times, more particularly in recent times. Yes. Well, of course, Plato, there was considerable influence of Plato in this Neoplatonism, which was such a bitter antagonist of Christianity that we looked at in the third century. Yes? It is, they did not express it clearly. And it is like the great truths of the scripture, like the great truths of science. When you come to know them, often seem so simple. You would think anybody with any sense would have seen this long ago. You might say anybody with any sense would see that it is far simpler to say that 100 centimeters make a meter and 1,000 meters make a kilometer than to say 12 inches make a foot and 3 feet make a yard and 5.5 yards make a rod. And how many rods make a mile? I don't know. And yet, we keep on with our silly habits in our English-speaking world. Despite the fact that something so much simpler and so much easier and so much clearer is established. The great advances often seem very simple once they happen, but people resist it. And it's a long time before anybody thinks of them often. Now, the same with the Trinity. We have a clear understanding of the Trinity that was worked out at the Council of Nicaea. But before that, people certainly believed in the Trinity, but they didn't express it clearly like we did. Now, the great service of Luther was to put into such clear language the fact that salvation is by faith alone, and that works contribute nothing to it. Because faith without works is dead, as Luther clearly recognized. Was that simple faith in Christ is the one thing that is vital for salvation. Now, we now can express that very clearly and very simply. I don't think it ever occurred to any of these men to express it as clearly and simply as that. But they had an understanding of it in varying degrees. And I'm sure that there were many people in the 13th century who had simple faith in Christ and were saved through it. But there were many others who thought that you had to have a real loyalty to the church, you had to go to mass, you had to do certain ceremonies, you had to do certain things. And if even among our finest Christian groups, you will find somebody who has made some little mistake in conduct, and they just feel as if the Lord can't possibly save them. And it's very hard to bring them to an understanding of the simple Trinity. We have a clear way of expressing, thanks largely to Luther, we have a clearer way of expressing these simple truths today than anybody had before. But that doesn't mean that there weren't a great many who had the truth before, and who were certainly saved through it. And Luther reprinted some of the works of Dominicans of the 14th century, the century we're just about to enter. He reprinted some of their work for what he felt was their very clear expression of some of the most vital aspects of the gospel. But their contemporaries did not feel a great difference between them and other people. And they were men whom the Roman Church never proceeded against, and so now they strongly try to defend their orthodoxy. And yet their statements were such that Luther very rightly felt that they were worthy of Christian people deriving great blessings from them today. Well, we better hurry on, the clock is moving. Let's look at numbers 12, the 14th century. And the 14th century, there is a old. That let me, before it's in the 14th century, just say one word about the Crusades. The Crusades were a great event in history. But as far as church history is concerned, they are a thing that has left very little effect on the present day. So we've paid very little attention to them. But as we leave the 13th century, we should note that this is the second of the two centuries over which the Crusades spread, from just before 1100 to just about 1300. And while they say the first Crusade, second, third, and fourth, and like that, yet those names are quite arbitrary. There was a constant series of troops going to the Near East to fight during these 200 years. And about 1300, it's the last real Western hold in the Near East was destroyed and taken over by the church. The book, The Source, which some of you may have seen, which was published by, written by Michener recently, a history of Palestine, a novel history of Palestine, written from quite an unbelieving viewpoint, but yet having some very vivid pictures of the number of heroes, has two chapters in it on the Crusades, and the first of them, in an imaginative form, describes the experiences of a German knight going to the Crusades in the beginning of the Crusades. And while some parts of it are overdrawn, it gives a very vivid picture of it. But I think even more interesting is the second of those chapters, which tells about the end of the Crusades. And this is 200 years later, and he shows the knight who was still living in Palestine. And their ancestors lived there for nearly 200 years. They come from Germany, and he shows the end of the Crusades. And it's a very, very vivid picture, and very, very well written. And if you just have time sometime to take that book, The Source, and read this one chapter, about 40 pages maybe, of the end of the Crusades, I think you'll find it very much worthwhile. But the Crusades ended as an important force at the end of the 13th century. Now, number 12, the 14th century. And the 14th century, McSorley begins his discussion with saying that in many respects, this century presented painful contrast with its predecessor. Catholic life declined amazingly. Looking back after the event, one discerns a stirring of forces which later brought about the religious revolution of the 16th century. The medieval world was being transformed in respect of political organization, social structure, spiritual outlook. Papal prestige and influence diminished. The power of excommunication lost its terror. This result was due not merely to the exaggerated claims of the more extreme papalists and to the financial policy pursued by the Avignon Court, but also and chiefly to political and social currents swirling through Europe. And then further down he says, a grave symptom was the stubborn resistance offered to the authority of the Holy See by three unrelated groups, the Franciscan spiritualists. That's a large group of the Franciscans who were trying to get back to the ideas of St. Francis. The Flagellants, another group that I don't know if we'll take much time on, and the English Wycliffeites, of whom we will have a good deal to say, who come at the end of this particular century. But now under the 14th century then, which is so different from the 13th, we will call number A the beginning of the so-called Babylonian captivity of the church. The beginning of the so-called Babylonian captivity of the church. At the end of the 13th century, Boniface VIII was ruling. And he tried to exert his authority like Innocent III had, but was not nearly as successful. So he spoke even more strongly than Boniface III had. And when he took a strong stand against King Philip of France, the representatives of the King of France, along with certain Roman nobles, attacked Boniface, and he was taken prisoner, and he died as a result of it. And then the French took over, to a large extent, the control of the papacy. And there we have some very interesting developments. He was succeeded as Pope by a man who only lived a very brief time, and then a Frenchman, Clement VI, was elected. The man who immediately succeeded Boniface VIII, McSorley says, died suddenly, and one of the leaders was suspected of having poisoned him. But his successor, Clement VI, a French archbishop, a personal friend of the French king, was elected after the French and Italian factions had deadlocked the conclave for nearly a year. And he gave evidence of subservience to the will of the French king. In 1309, 4 years after he became pope, he moved the center of the papacy to France. And there at a town called Avignon, A-V-I-G-N-O-N, in southern France, he established the papal headquarters. And for 68 years, the papacy continued most of the time to have its headquarters there. Now, 68 immediately reminds you of 70. And 70 immediately reminds you of Jeremiah's prophecy that Jerusalem would lie fallow for 70 years. The Babylonian captivity, approximately 70 years. And so it wasn't long after the Pope went back to Rome that the time in France came to be spoken of as the Babylonian captivity of the church, the 70 years, more or less corresponding. During this time, the papacy had its headquarters in Avignon, but they still were nominally the bishops of Rome. And they claimed their authority because they were bishops of Rome. During this period at Avignon, to quite an extent, the popes were trying to carry on the influence, the control in European affairs that the popes had exerted in the 13th century, but this was largely secondary to them. It wasn't final as it had been the previous century. These were largely popes who were interested in their own pleasures, their own enrichment, their own advantages, personally, and their families. And the Avignon popes are, on the whole, men of a much lower standing than the popes of the previous century. Some of them were better men than the previous ones, some were worse men. But they did not have that quite as strong an influence throughout Europe, though they were still getting tremendous income from all over Europe, which they were, a great part of which they were turning to their own pleasure. Now, King Philip immediately demanded that Clement VI declare that Boniface VIII never should have been a pope, that Boniface VIII was utterly unworthy. In fact, there was such great dislike of Boniface VIII that when Dante at about this time wrote the famous Divine Comedy, he pictured Boniface VIII as in hell. And he, in fact, Dante only put one of the popes in heaven. Out of all of them, in his Divine Comedy. And he put a number of them in hell and the rest in purgatory. But Dante is very strong in his denunciation of Boniface VIII at various places in his Divine Comedy, which he wrote at about this time. Now the King of France tried to get Clement V to declare that Boniface VIII was unorthodox, that he was wicked, that he could not even be considered as having been a pope. But Clement strongly resisted this, and it would seem that perhaps it was, some say, that it was in resisting this that he gave in to Philip on something else that Philip wanted. In the end, they had a great meeting at which they had an examination of Boniface VIII, of his claims to have been a true pope, and in the end they decided by a small margin that he had been. And so the King of France did not have his will in degrading the memory of Boniface VIII, but he did get what he wanted in this other point. And so I'm going to make this be the destruction of the Templars. The destruction of the Templars, T-E-M-P-L-A-R-S. Those of you who have read Ivanhoe and remember anything about it, of course, are quite familiar with the Knights Templar. We did not mention, in connection with the Crusades, that there were certain new orders started. The Knights Templars, the Knights of Malta, and the Knights Hospitallers. Orders which were half monks and half soldiers. Soldier or medical man. The hospitalers were sort of in between. But these orders were active in connection with the Crusades, and then they acquired considerable wealth and had headquarters in many countries of Europe. In Ivanhoe, he pictures the Templars as having their great castles in England, and he gives quite a vivid picture of them as very bigoted, and yet including among their number some pretty wicked people. Well, the Templars by this time had become very wealthy. And it would seem that Philip of France wanted this wealth for himself. At least, Philip began to demand that the Templars be examined and that various charges brought against them be investigated And Clement went along with it. There's reason to think he hesitated, but he did not resist. He went along with it. And the result was that all over Europe, the Templars were seized and many of them tortured in order to make them confess that they had attacked Christ, that they had spit on the cross, that they had in their orders the most abominable offenses against moral decency. All sorts of charges were brought against them. The Inquisition was used. The Pope ordered the order should be disbanded. And in Paris, 36 of these died under torture. 54 were burned on one day, publicly burned. Hundreds perished in prison. All over Europe, the Templars, the Knights Templars, were subjected to this terrible treatment. Until in the end, the Grand Master of the Templars was publicly convicted of having denied Christ and spit upon the cross. At his trial, he confessed that he had done these things. He was condemned, but then he said it was true. Here he had confessed that it was wrong. He never had done these. He was then again tried, and he was with others. He was led to the front of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris and sentenced to perpetual imprisonment. And then the general of the Templars stood up and declared the charges against the order were false, that he confessed to them under the strain of torture and instructions from the king. And his right-hand man did the same. The commission promised to reconsider the case the next day. But that night, these men were taken out in front of Notre Dame Cathedral and there were publicly burned. And the story was told later that people heard in the midst of the burning the grand, head of the Templars publicly call out that he was summoning the Pope and the King to meet him at God's judgment bar within a year. Now, whether that's what he said or not, we can't tell, but that's the story that went around. And the fact is that in little more than a month after this, the Pope died of a loathsome disease. And 6 months later, the king was killed by accident while he was hunting. And the many have tried to make great heroes of the Templars who perish in this. Certainly, it is one of the most execrable things in the history of the papacy. Whether the Pope, to how great an extent he caused this to happen, and to how great an extent he gave in to the king of France. The fact is that these men, well, were hundreds of them tortured and killed, and there's no proof of any reason for it except the desire of the King of France to seize their property, which the King of France seized in France. In other orders, in other countries, it was given some of it to other orders, some of it seized by the local authorities. In England, they took their property in London, and it was eventually became the headquarters of many of the courts of England. You will read about the Inner Temple in Dickens' works or in other writings about England in the last century or so, which refers to what used to be the property of the Templars, but at this time have passed into the hands of the King of England. Yes? Well, we'll continue that tomorrow.